It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. A very difficult week, but we have three really great people who will help us understand everything. Amy Webb, our futurist. Dan Gilmore, an expert on journalism and media literacy. And from the big technology podcast and newsletter, Alex Kantrowitz. We're going to talk, of course, about the bans of the president on pretty much every social media network. Is this the right direction to go? Is big tech too powerful? Who's in charge and why? We'll talk about something Amy is an expert on, China nationalizing one of its biggest corporations, Alibaba, and what that really means. We'll celebrate the birthday of Wikipedia and the iPhone. There's lots to talk about, and TWiT is next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 805, recorded Sunday, January 10th, 2021. Come together like Voltron. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Barracuda. Did you know that 91% of all cyber attacks start with an email? To uncover the threats hiding in your Office 365 account, get a secure and free email threat scan at barracuda.com/twit. And by ExpressVPN. Stop handing over your personal data to ISPs who mine your activity and sell off your information. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/twit. And by Mint Mobile. Switching to Mint Mobile's premium wireless service is the easiest way to save this year. Maximize your savings with plans starting at just $15 a month. And get the plan shipped to your door for free at mintmobile.com/twit. And by the TriCaster 2 Elite from NewTek, the most complete live production system on the planet. There's a TriCaster for every production, including yours, including ours. Go to newtek.com/TriCaster for an interactive guide that'll help you choose which TriCaster is right for you. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we talk about the week's tech news, and oh boy, is there news. But I have the perfect panel assembled for this particular wild week. Let's start with Amy Webb, who is a futurist with the Future Today Institute, author of a number of really good books about big tech, amyweb.io. And Amy, I have my Future Today magic 8-ball with me in case we need it, if it should come up. You did a great calendar, and I forgot to bring it in, but it's beautiful for 2021. You hired 12 different illustrators to talk about trends, future trends, and illustrate them, and it's really beautiful. I just really love it. Is that available somewhere?
It's free. Yeah, most of our stuff is free. So we made a speculative travel calendar, so it's a speculative design futures project. Every month is a different country, so it looks like an old school, beautiful 1950s travel poster collection. Mm-hmm. But if you look closely, every single month tells us something about technology, biology, things about the future. And it starts, January is a trip to nowhere. These airlines are now flying trips to nowhere. For wealthy people. Yeah. Anyhow, so it's all available on our Futures Today Institute website. You can download the whole thing, all the travel posters, the calendar.
Cool. That's really cool. FutureTodayInstitute.com. Also want to welcome back, it's been a long time, but I still consider him one of the premier experts on media today. Dan Gilmore, longtime reporter at the Mercury News, who's now kind of focused on media literacy. Hi, Dan. It's great to see you again.
Fine to be back. It has been a long
time. It's been too long, and I apologize, but I'm thrilled to have you on. And again, perfect timing. And we also want to welcome somebody brand new. Longtime tech reporter, Alex Kantrowitz, who now is doing his own thing on Substack, bigtechnology.substack.com. It's also the Big Technology podcast. It is great to meet you, Alex. I've seen you many times on Tech News Weekly, and I'm so glad we could get you on TWiT as well.
Thank you, Leo. Yeah, it's a thrill here. And when I was starting out to do my own thing, I was trying to learn from the best. And I read one of the formative documents for me was reading your guide on how to build a successful podcast. And I've really kept that in mind. And so I appreciate your advice there. And it's a thrill to be on with you right now.
That's very kind of you. And you'll really appreciate its sequel, how to do a failing podcast.
Oh, I'm well on the way on that front.
It turns out pretty easy. No, it's not failing, but it's been a tough year thanks to COVID and advertisers being very, I don't think it's just COVID. In fact, I've noticed as the year went on that they got more and more nervous about the future. And while I don't think stopping advertising is probably the best way to face the future, I understand budgets are tight and a lot of businesses are going, yeah, where can we cut? And the first thing you cut is a podcast.
I would say smart advertisers should place on podcasts, and particularly here, you don't get a more intimate relationship with people who are consuming media outside of podcasts. So. Yeah.
You know that, and I know that.
That's right.
And we do have a number of very loyal advertisers who feel the same way. Thank you. We're glad that we can still do this show. I do not. I'm just going to say a caveat up front. While we occasionally get political on all of our shows, we're not here to be political. We're not here to flog a political viewpoint. But more and more recently, over the last 5 years, for sure, there's been an intersection between politics and technology. And it's hard to avoid that, especially because this was the week that the president of the United States got himself banned on Twitter, Facebook, Spotify, YouTube, even Pinterest and TikTok for inflammatory comments. And I guess the first thing... I would like to ask all three of you. I mean, I think that there's probably no question that when anybody, president or not, says things that incite violence and really cause problems, that it's not unreasonable to censure them in some way. And Twitter's done that with warning messages and now completely banning the president. But it also raises in some people's minds the specter of big tech suddenly weighing in on political issues. And it really brings home the power big tech has. We saw stories that the president's press people were casting around, where can we put his videos? There's nowhere we could put his videos. And maybe they were looking perhaps at conservative alternatives like Gab and Parler, but even those alternatives are slowly being shut down. Both Gab and Parler were under threat. Parler ended up being pulled from the Google App Store first and then later from the Apple App Store, which, by the way, caused it to be the number one app as hundreds of thousands of people downloaded it quickly before it got banned. And now the latest is at midnight tonight Pacific time. Amazon Web Services says we're going to pull Parler down because there's too many posts like the one that says let's all kill the vice president. We don't feel right serving that. So let me start with you, Alex, because you cover big technology. This is something big technology has resisted, but all the resistance was over after Wednesday. What's your take on that?
Well, look, there's a reason why they resisted this. They knew that if they were going to make this move, they were going to form a good amount of antitrust sentiment in the House and the Senate in a way that they hadn't previously, and they were already on the hot seat, for being mildly interventionist, not taking action like removing the president's Twitter account. Yeah. And I think what they're looking at right now is something pretty serious for their business, which is that you have the House Democrats and the Senate who basically got turned onto antitrust after the 2016 election, where they felt that big tech had too much power and blamed it for the election of Donald Trump and had taken antitrust investigations against big tech very seriously. I mean, really looking deeply into this stuff and getting further than Congress had ever gotten before. So you already had that brewing with congressional Democrats. Now you're going to have them joined with a group of Republicans who are furious over what's happened. And they knew that this would happen, and that's why they resisted it. That's why you saw moments where Trump would say, you know, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, or any other form of, attempts to delegitimize the 2020 election. They let that slide. It was only until this moment where they realized it would be, you know, basically impossible for them to face their employees and to face their board if they allowed him to stay on. They waited until this moment. So it was almost as if their hand was forced at the very last minute here. They obviously took action to ban him. Facebook might let him back on. But I think ultimately what the result of this is a very strong bipartisan push for serious new antitrust legislation that's going to come for these companies.
And yet I don't think anybody disputes that if somebody is advocating violence, particularly the violent takeover of Congress, that that's something that should not be permitted on these things. Right, Dan? I mean, this is very challenging. Mike Masnick wrote a really interesting piece. His headline, not easy, not unreasonable, not censorship. The decision to ban Trump from Twitter, which, you know, the problem is the goalposts are constantly moving.
Yeah. Well, Twitter had for a long time what we might call the presidential exception to the rules. Basically, he's the president, so we're going to let him break the rules.
Which is not unreasonable.
And you can make a case. And yeah. I had been assuming that on January 20th, we were going to learn about a new ex-presidential exception. But Twitter, for its own reasons, and they're a private company, they can do what they want. That is to say, they're not the government. And it's certainly justifiable on many grounds that they said enough is enough and stopped it. The issue, and what Alex was talking about, is really relevant. This is my question, and while I certainly agree that the companies have the right to edit, to manage their spaces any way they want, the question I have is, do we really want a small number of giant enterprises to decide what is allowed in the way of speech in the United States in the giant public square we call the internet? And they do more than not make those decisions. I worry a lot about the consequences of the brigade of do something people who have been screaming at platforms to do something about all this. And when they get their way, they may in the long run wonder why they wanted quite that much intervention. We're not thinking this stuff through, and I'm quite worried about it.
I mean, it's not as if the president of the United States doesn't have – it's a bully pulpit, as Teddy Roosevelt said. He has plenty of ways he can express his opinion. There's a lot of conservative talk radio. There are conservative television networks. There are plenty of places he can tell the world what he thinks. You know, I had mixed feelings, too, because at least when he's tweeting, that gives you some insight into what his thinking is and what he's planning and what he's up to. Mm-hmm. In some ways, going dark on the president at this point is a scary thought, not a reassuring thought. And yet at the same time, I think it's completely reasonable if you're a social network to say, yeah, but you can't incite violence. There are certain things even the president can't do. And the violent overthrow of the American government is definitely in that category. Amy, what do you think?
I have a lot of thoughts.
I bet you do. We all do, obviously.
I do. Let me start, because I think disclosures in my case are important, by saying I am politically independent. We do quite a bit of work with different federal government agencies and with the military. And obviously with lots of other different companies. So with that being said, so Alex mentioned the antitrust enthusiasm in the wake of the 2016 elections, and it actually predates that. So Elizabeth Warren and some others have been charging now for years that our big tech companies have amassed a considerable amount of power and wield tremendous influence. If this was an ecosystem in the natural world, we would relate the big tech companies to a keystone species, meaning that these companies have outsized influence now on the places in which they operate, and the things that they do have serious consequences and reverberations. So as I see it, we have three core problems related to what happened last week, and they're all tech related. So the first core problem, you know, Dan mentioned we've got a relatively small group of people who are making decisions for all of us. And that is true, that that group of people is based in the Valley. We also have a small group of people in Washington, D.C., making decisions that impact all of us. And that's the Supreme Court. There's a tension inherent between the decisions that are being made in response to the evolving nature of our technology, speech, and society by the technology companies and the static laws of the United States, laws that are not intended to change. There's this tension between the two. And resolving that tension, I think, is not just critical to get through where we are right now, but it's going to have to be the cornerstone of how law evolves over the next couple of years. Because if that doesn't happen, then the mechanisms by which we make a lot of decisions no longer make sense. So part of what's happening right now is an indiscriminate use of terms of service. The big long post that Zuckerberg relayed, the letter from Twitter, what they are doing is trying to make legalistic arguments having to do with the terms of service. You know, and the problem is that there was a study from Carnegie Mellon a couple years ago showing that if we stopped to read all of the terms of service that are presented to us, it would take 76 work days, so 8 hours a day, or 15 work weeks, because the median length of privacy policies is around 2,500 words. Now, if you stop, you know, and that's just, so if you assume that you are reading the TOS and you're thinking about what you are agreeing to, right, you could even go further and show that, you know, in terms of work lost in exchange for us reading all of these terms of service, it's like hundreds of billions of dollars. And my point is that tech companies are making up the interpretations of these terms of service as they go along, which is in conflict with the laws that they are intended to respond to. You know, indiscriminate application of terms of service to some extent is how we got to now. And ultimately, that's what took some of these key figures off of the networks. But in some way, they don't matter, because it's not just Trump who is the problem here. It's algorithmic determinism. It's the systems that are designed to pull content not just from him, but now from all of these other places. So Trump may be gone and AWS may have taken Parler offline, but the problem is the infrastructure supporting all of this. And I will say one last thing, and that has to do with world building, because all of this reached a sort of fever pitch in the past couple of days. And again, I say this as somebody who's politically independent. The people surrounding Donald Trump have done a masterful job of world building. They created something called Antifa. They created something called QAnon, which may have been bubbling up here and there, you know, may have had little fits and spurts, but
certainly if they didn't create it, they certainly fostered it.
First of all, it makes me crazy that the way that it's being pronounced is Antifa. There is no long E sound in the word Antifa, but whatever. The point is that
it's short for anti-fascist, Antifa.
Whatever.
It doesn't matter. It's made up anyway.
But here's why it does matter. Because I was at the State Department in 2012 through 2016, as were others, talking about intentional misinformation and how this has significant next order outcomes. And it would be good to red team some of this in advance to think these things through. And it just, you know, didn't happen.
Yeah.
So we really have to think hard, because it just taking some of these people offline and taking Parler and Gab, you know, out of the Play Store, There are mirror sites already. Like, somebody created a mirror site of a subreddit that had gotten taken down. That this doesn't.
It's virtually impossible to eliminate this stuff.
That's right. That's right. So anyhow, we have three core problems that are unfortunately, from my vantage point, not going away. And the compounding effect here is that we've got a transition of power. It's cold in a lot of places where Americans live, and we have no holidays to look forward to.
January's always sucks. So
I mean, but this tells us, and we've got COVID that's, you know, so we have to really think through not just what happened last week in a vacuum, but also how does, you know, the mechanisms that we have to deal with some of this no longer make sense. Is the challenge.
Well, and, you know, despite all the rules of engagement and the terms of service, it doesn't seem to be enforced equitably across the board. We all have experience of Twitter being used for blatantly illegal threats and so forth. And it's very difficult to get those taken down, if at all. It almost feels like the rules are applied, and this is what was Mike Masnick's point. They're applied completely ad hoc at will, and in a way, that's more scary because it's Jack Dorsey and Mark Zuckerberg and their ilk who are deciding things that are pretty important. And yet, I don't know of any other mechanism to do this. Dan, you focus on media literacy. Yeah. Is that a solution? Is sometimes people say, well, you can't blame the platforms, blame the people using them.
Well, let me start off by a disclosure or two on my own. I have been vehemently worried about Trump since before he was president, and loudly and publicly warning about the danger that I thought he represented to the Republic. And secondly, the work that we're doing at Arizona State University News Collab, which is the thing I work on, has gotten some funding from social media companies like Facebook. We are involved in a Defense Department project and some other things. So my disclosures are all on my website, and I welcome people to look at that. If we think about it again, from the notion that this sort of ad hocracy of response to these problems that are coming up, it's exactly right. Mike Masnick, whose Tech Dirt site is must read from my perspective, he's correct that basically companies wait for a big enough, loud enough, public enough problem and then do something about that. Because it's impossible to moderate at scale. It can't be done. There is literally no way to do it except through bad AI that doesn't work well. It's incredibly hard.
Right.
So it is natural that they're going to wait for the biggest problem to show up and then do something about that. And meanwhile, a lot of things that are much worse don't get noticed except by the people who become the victims of those.
The Myanmar junta, so, President Duterte in the Philippines, Modi in India, the leader of the Taliban, the leader of Iran, all have a bully pulpit on Twitter. Still.
Yeah. It's so.
And Facebook.
But what I'm as worried about rules that would basically drive out almost everything that's interesting, as well as the bad stuff. And we've got to be cautious about how we try to attack this. And by the way, no one's mentioned the role, the pernicious role of big journalism, as I call it, which does not just include the right-wing networks like Fox and others. But keep in mind, for years, until quite recently, our biggest journalism organizations happily parroted what serial liars were telling them every day, and occasionally would say, by the way, that's not true.
And doing it because it was good for ratings, I might point out.
Well,
ideology.
I think that's part of it. I think there's also journalistic norms which are clearly out of date when one side of a, it's not a debate, it's, you know, there's something that's real and something that's not. But when party in power says the sky is green, there's no journalistic obligation to publish that or to broadcast that. Right. And yet the norms of journalism were hacked against the Republic. And there's very good data now from a Harvard study and from a Cornell study that strongly suggests that more the public got more misinformation via regular television than it did from the social networks.
Absolutely.
In the last year. So it's not conclusive data, but it's pretty persuasive to me.
I think you lump it all together into one kind of modern, and I think you could say social media is and mainstream media. There's this, it's a modern condition of just kind of a barrage of material, factual and non-factual, that makes it almost impossible to have any reasonable discourse, even among people who disagree. When the Wall Street Journal's editorial board says Trump should resign, the immediate interpretation is that, well, oh, Rupert Murdoch has turned against him. I mean, he wields a lot of power, as probably as much as Twitter and Facebook does. Kevin Roos writing in the New York Times, in pulling Trump's megaphone, Twitter shows where power now lies. And I think that's, to me, that's really where the tech conversation goes, is when you talk about big tech, Alex, what is the context? Are you saying, what is your feeling? Are they too powerful? There's certainly, you could point to a lot of good that has come from big tech. I don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. Or should we?
Yeah.
What do you do? Or can we?
I mean, that's the question that we're going to be focusing on, at least for the next 2 years, and probably longer, given that the antitrust cases are now underway against Facebook and Google at the FTC and Department of Justice. And believe me, after this week, Apple and Amazon are definitely on their way for cases of their own.
Yeah.
So, look, I don't view it. These are tough questions without simple answers. Are they too powerful? Yes, no doubt about it. These are enormous companies. I mean, if you think about it, as we've been through this pandemic, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Google and Microsoft have made up at times 25% or more of the S&P 500. That's supposed to be a long, you know, a very diverse portfolio of the companies that really make up the American economy. So what does it mean when there are five companies that end up taking up a quarter of that space? It means that the government can't let them fail in certain ways, because if these companies were to, seriously decline, then you could end up taking a chunk out of the market. So it means that, you know, even when there is accountability, it has to be done with a scalpel, right? It can't be done with a sledgehammer.
That's my problem. I don't know where there is a solution for this. Amy wrote the book, The Big Nine, which includes, besides those five, Tencent, Baidu, and Alibaba. How has that changed, by the way, China's censorship of Alibaba? Is that
I got to tell you, to me, I mean, as disastrous as what we saw in the Capitol last week, the news story that really went underreported and unnoticed was China's provocative move just after Christmas to nationalize Alibaba. Yeah. For those of you not familiar with Alibaba, it's a enormous conglomerate, on par with Amazon in many ways. But let me give you a quick
And Jack Ma insight. Disappeared.
Yep.
Whether he
Jack
was,
Ma, yeah. I don't know that he like went disappeared.
I don't think the government disappeared him, but he had the good sense to shut up and lay low.
Right. So this is this was the beginning of the catastrophic scenario that I wrote about in the Big Nine, and that I turns my stomach to see we are inching closer to every day. But here's a really interesting insight into Alibaba. So just before Double 11, which is Singles Day, so November 11th every year, big shopping holiday across China. It's a sort of national holiday. It's also a time when Alibaba rolls out some of its new AI. Last year, Alibaba some of the new AI systems were using a new, much more sophisticated type of predictive analytics to understand in advance, not just based on prior shopping habits, but all types of other data sources, which are now being collected by a panopticon, as well as behavioral data. All of those data were collected to try to predict in advance what people would shop for on that day.
I remember reading that story as like a human interest story. Isn't that cool? Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Well, what it's really not, though.
No.
They were able to predict with 80% accuracy 500,000 people's orders. They pre-packed those boxes and got them ready for shipment. So from an e-commerce point of view, like, what a win. But think, if you stop for a moment and ask yourself what it took to make that happen. And now that this is no longer, in as much as it was an independent company because it was domiciled in China, the fact that this is now nationalized should be, you know, it should send shivers up your spine. And now let's go one step further and say, what if Parler, instead of, you know, if Azure and Google and Amazon won't allow it to happen, what if it went over to AliCloud?
Like, oh, wow.
What happens if China hosted Parler? It would be a... So now here's
the Russian equivalent, which I'm sure exists. Yeah.
China would be a more realistic equivalent, but here's the interesting thing. Like, it would be a provocation, but it's not exactly a digital act of war. I mean, it is totally plausible that all of these sites and people that are getting kicked off of our networks wind up on a Chinese network, which we would be able to access. And then think of the data stores. There's something called CFIUS, but if you're using that, that would prevent something like that in the U.S.
The Committee for Foreign Investment in the U.S.
Yeah.
The cognitive dissonance of all of the Parler crowd fleeing to China virtually is like, whoa, it makes my head spin.
Well, but they may not know. I mean, if somebody, say Alibaba, to any, like, they're not going to, half the people who are clicking on Russia Today story is a little green box with an RT.
They don't know. That's right.
They have no idea. It's part of the Kremlin.
And Amy is right, by the way, about the most Americans have no idea the power and breadth of the big companies in China. And I never expected Jack Ma to run afoul of the government because he had been so much in league with the government for so long. I was totally shocked that that happened.
He went too far.
Well, China is doing its best to anger everybody right now who's outside of China. It's amazing.
What did Jack Ma do, Amy?
This was not Jack Ma doing anything. This is so much like our big tech make up a disproportionate part of the S&P in the United States. The economic prowess of not just Alibaba, but again, this is a huge ecosystem. So there's something called Ant Financial. There's many other companies within that umbrella that wields so much economic power that in some ways, you know, they are a threat to the CCP, to the Chinese government. So I don't think this was like Jack Ma ticked off Xi Jinping. I think this was a response to the enormous power that Alibaba on its own can wield and the sensitive and hyper advanced computer vision, you know, AI systems that are under its purview made it a target for the Chinese government.
It's fascinating.
So at one level,
that's
interest. You're saying the government, U.S. government has been unwilling to do anything about the hegemony of tech in this country, and the Chinese government said, wait a minute, this can't go on. They're getting too powerful. That's such an interesting contrast that has no parallel, but it's interesting.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Alex.
I mean, it's a fascinating parallel that both in China and the U.S., governments are viewing these companies as more powerful in some ways than the government, or so powerful that they need to be reckoned with. And you have what happened in China, and now you look at, Facebook and Twitter, for instance, and Google and Amazon, you know, shutting down the president's account or pulling the ability for sites that are populated by his supporters to sustain themselves. And you start to look at this. We're still kind of young in the internet age. I mean, it's a very small sliver of human history, and we're already at the point where there's now this unbelievable tension between these big companies and the government. I mean, it's a fascinating thing And this is definitely, I mean, we're probably just at the beginning of the push and pull between governments and companies, nowhere near the end.
The problem I have, and we're going to take a break, so I'm going to give you all a minute or two to come up with a solution, because that's the problem I have. You split up Facebook, you just create more Facebooks. You don't. It's like Hydra. You're not solving the problem. You're multiplying the problem. You can't force them to divest Instagram and WhatsApp, and even if you did, what does that accomplish? It's almost for me, and we've been for the last at least 2 years, this has been one of the big conversations. Amy, you know, we've had this conversation many times on many of our shows. But for me, that's the most intractable problem, is what is the solution? So I'll give each of you a little time to think of how you would solve this. And if there is a solution, because I'm baffled. And we'll talk about it when we come back. We have a great panel for maybe one of the most momentous weeks for big tech ever. Amy Webb is here from the Future Today Institute. And again, I highly recommend her book on the Big Nine, which includes the five American companies, but Tencent and Alibaba and Baidu as well. And it's very timely. Alex Kantrowitz is here. His podcast is called Big Tech, Big Technology, and his newsletter is at bigtechnology.substack.com. And media specialist Dan Gilmore. It's been a long time. I'm so glad to have you back. Three big minds. Maybe we can come up with an answer that this little mind has a hard time figuring out. Our show today brought to you by Barracuda. You know the name if you know security. Barracuda is a provider of cloud-enabled enterprise-grade security solutions to protect you, your email, your networks, your data, your applications. Let's just think about email for a second. 91% of all cyber attacks start in an email. I'm reminded of the big aluminum company, Norsk Hydro, which got an innocent email from one of its customers in Italy with an attachment. The attachment, when the customer sent it, was benign, but email hijacking meant that the bad guys were able to replace that attachment with malware. An executive at Norsk Hydro opened it. All of their operations were shut down for weeks due to ransomware. That's one email. One bad attachment. An email you expected with an attachment you expected from a customer you knew. And imagine now you have all your employees are out there. They're working from home. Every one of them gets email, hundreds every day, laden with spear phishing, ransomware, account takeover, conversation hijacking. One click is all it takes to cost you money, customers, to cost you your reputation. I think I've probably convinced you you need to do something about this. The researchers at Barracuda have noticed a spike of 667% in coronavirus-related spear phishing attacks. They impersonate the World Health Organization, the CDC. They use domain spoofing. They'll promise employees information relating to COVID-19, maybe our new company policy. Open this PDF. And of course, it's a phishing scam. You need Barracuda Total Email Protection. It includes all-in-one email security. You also get backup and archiving, something you need in a lot of businesses by law. You get AI-based protection from spear phishing, account takeover, and business email compromise. Why AI-based? Because hackers don't sit still. These attacks evolve, they modify, they're constantly changing. And so your protection has to be smart enough to update itself all the time, to notice if something seems suspicious. They've got a great automated incident response system. And that's important because, of course, the faster you respond to these attacks, the better able to stop them you are. You also get security awareness training. So your workforce, your employees, your front line can be your first line of defense against attacks. I've got a deal for you. To uncover the threats hiding in your inbox, you can get a secure, free email threat scan of your Office 365 account, completely risk-free, at barracuda.com/twit. B-A-R-R-A, Barra, C-U-D-A, like the fish with the pointy teeth, barracuda.com/twit. Uncover the threats hiding in your inbox. A free threat scan. I know probably there's some of you saying, I don't want to know. You need, but trust me, you need to know. Barracuda, your journey secured. And fortunately, they have a good solution if you do find anything nefarious in there. Barracuda. Thank you, Barracuda, for your support of This Week in Tech. And thank you, dear listener, for using that address. That lets them know you heard it here. Barracuda.com/twit. All right. Is this crazy, Amy, for me to say what's the solution? Is that reductionist?
It's not. I should have been paying attention to Barracuda, but instead I was thinking through.
No, that's fine. That was your job. Question. That was your assignment.
All right.
What do we do?
So typically, you know, when we wind up in these complex situations with that are multivariate, that roll out in different ways into the future, we look for a historic analog of some kind. And I was just trying to think of one. I've been trying to think of one, and I keep
that's
coming
part
back
of the problem.
The
there's
well,
nothing.
There isn't
there's
one.
Never been anything like Facebook.
Right.
The power that Mark Zuckerberg, one guy, wields, controls the entire media universe, and that's just one platform, is I think, unparalleled.
Right. So, I mean, he owned, because of his shares, he has a lot of say. But this is not just about people and entities. If it was a people and entity problem, it would be an easier problem to solve. This is people, entities, and code. So the challenge, at least, you know, Twitter is a different situation, but there's a lot of Frankenstein code floating around Facebook. And I've had a lot of conversations with folks there about creating different hierarchies and taxonomies and deprioritizing things. And I think the bottom line, when I hear like, you know, yes, we've thought about that, but we really don't know how to adjust the products. I think that they're probably right. I think they probably do not know. I'm sure that there are billions of lines of code at this point.
We could stipulate that there's no technological solution Facebook could employ.
Well, I think there could be. One of the things that I think that the solution going forward, there's nothing is immediate. So any true immediate near-term action, I think, is going to lead to any action taken. There has to be action taken by the technology companies because this reached fever pitch and because they're facing, after January 20th, significant action. The problem is to take those actions is going to further upset a lot of the people who are currently angry, and they're going to find other places where that anger foments, and it leads to additional problems. So at the moment, I think the red team response is not a tech one. I think it's an actual like security apparatus one for the next couple of months. But then what do we do? And I keep coming back to infrastructure. In the book, in the Big Nine, I make a pretty, I think, clear argument for why AI needs to be thought of as a public good. And I've been having conversations with people about how we could treat our transmission. So, you know, is there a way to create an open source architecture upon which some of these websites would sit, using immutable records, so that at least there was some additional control beyond Facebook's Supreme Court, whatever it's called, and beyond Jack deciding finally today, you know, to make a difference, that the social networks would have shared infrastructure. That's obviously a longer play. I think Tim Berners-Lee is working on something that's decentralized. And I keep coming to that point, and then I remember actually decentralization is potentially worse because
bloom.
Yeah. So that leads me to I work on really long-term systems level change, and nothing changes until we depoliticize tech and do that intentionally. So I last October, I was at the Senate talking about a new policy, a national strategic foresight office. We do not do
long-term planning
in the United States.
We need that desperately. We need that desperately.
So I've been working really hard for 2 years to get that up and running, because if we you know, the challenge is that the laws that people are using to support the everything that's misinformation, bad photos, bad stuff that's being sent, they're using the First Amendment. And the problem is that the First Amendment was written in the days before there technically was an algorithm, but it hadn't been operationalized and like productized on the internet yet, right? So that's the problem. And that's a problem that's going to take much longer to solve, longer than the hours and weeks we have ahead of what might be another violent attack.
I'm very concerned about January 20th.
Yeah.
I think the only, well, basically Washington, D.C. is going to be a battleground, and you're going to have troops. I mean, I'm just terrified. And I think there, not only is there going to be violence, I think there's going to be deaths. I'm very scared about what's going to happen in a week. But that's another topic that also has no obvious and easy solution. What about the free speech solution? The only solution to bad speech is more free speech. Dan, is that reasonable? More speech.
Well, like all simple solutions, it's incomplete and sometimes wrong. I do tend to be a free speech First Amendment absolutist. I do think that we, to address your original question, what do we do? I don't think there's anything wrong with breaking up to, in whatever way possible, the power of the companies that now dominate everything. And yes, that would probably create lots of spinoffs, and which are already starting to happen because of the actions that the big companies are taking as we speak. I think that's okay, that there's going to be 1,000 flowers blooming. It doesn't mean that I'm happy about the fact that there will be more and more individual spaces for bad people to gather and plan and do things. But we have to decide whether we believe at some fundamental level in free speech that's loathsome, but not at the point where it's advocating the overthrow of governments in ways where people are actually plotting to do things and saying, let's go and kill these people. That, I think anybody would agree that's too far. But prior restraint is something that just doesn't have a place in this country.
Right.
And we should keep that in mind. We re-decentralization is a great idea.
Well, not something like federation or, if Facebook published an API and there were 1,000 Facebooks that could be federated, something like that.
Well, that was the open infrastructure.
Facebook.
That's what you were talking about.
And Amy's, what Amy's talking about and working on is really important and a good idea. I think that I've been in touch with these people for years. Places around the valley, Silicon Valley, people are working on re-decentralizing technologies and doing some fabulous stuff. Mostly young people say this is crazy, the system that exists.
That at least eliminates Mark Zuckerberg threat.
That's the longest of long-term plays, but because Facebook's so entrenched. But the notion that we further entrench them by making laws that make them the default everything is even worse from my point of view. And I will come back to. I do think re-decentralizing is a fine idea. It's hard, but people are working on it. And the final one of the fixes is that we have to stop obsessing solely about the supply, bad as it may be, of information and the inundation of bad stuff. And we have to not just upgrade the information supply, but we have to upgrade us, the demand.
Yeah.
We have to do better at that. And that, I would say that because that's what I work on. But I think there's not nearly enough attention being paid to that side of it.
Do you think it's possible that people could be taught better content moderation, literacy? Obviously, you do. That's what you're pursuing. I fear that human nature is such that we really look for things that confirm our beliefs. And that's the problem I feel with tools like Facebook is they foster that. They make it very easy for you to create a bubble that's sympathetic to your beliefs, and that's that.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Amy.
I don't want to move away from the breaking up big tech.
Okay.
Let's argument do that. So just we can come back to it, but I
no, go ahead. decentralized. What was it?
Decentralizing.
So I want to make the conditions for competition better.
That's a good way to do it.
What I want there to be more competition. Yes. And breaking up the companies is very hard, maybe impossible, but create conditions under which more competition is possible. And that may include restricting a lot of what current winners are doing. And it's very hard, but we have to have more competition from my perspective, or we have no chance in solving
it. It does, though. There's the problem is the network effect. I mean, we have tried federation. We use a federated Twitter called Mastodon, but because nobody's on it, nobody uses it. And so you could create 1,000 Facebooks, but there needs to be. But if all your friends are on Facebook 222, that's the one you're going to use. So I feel like the network effect is working against decentralization. Amy, go ahead.
So, right. So here, I think that decentralization is somewhat of an inevitability, but not for many tiny communities. Otherwise, Keybase would be bigger than it is right now.
Right.
I think it has more to do with how the infrastructure evolves. But I wanted to come back to this notion of breaking up big tech because inevitably, this is what is discussed when we talk about the future of these technology companies. And in parallel, the breaking up of the baby bells is usually the reference that's made. We cannot, it would be a problem for our national security if we break these, if we force these companies to be broken up. And the reason for that is because the United States for the past several administrations has either actively not invested in basic science and research or basic research in science and technology, or they've defunded a lot of the departments that would be doing this. Absent of large scale funding into critical areas of development for things like not just artificial intelligence, but also space and you know, the batteries that go into our autonomous vehicles and next frontier technologies like synthetic biology, if the government is not going to pour money, lots and lots of money into these things, that at a level that keeps pace with what other, like China is doing, then this causes us a problem in the longer term. At the moment, it is just these companies, in part because they're so well capitalized, that are doing that work, but they are doing that work in service of their own products and services because the market spanks them otherwise when it's revealed how much R&D spend there is. So we can't break. I mean, there are logistical reasons. The federal government runs on AWS. I don't know how you're going to break apart Amazon in any meaningful way because so much of that company is so interconnected. But you know, my question is like, who is going to do the work? Who is going to fund the work? And I'm not saying that the big tech companies are doing it now is good either. They're essentially just working with a handful of universities. It's an incestuous, very narrow, homogenous group of people who are building all of these things. But the point is, if they don't, it's not going to happen at the same level. And that is going to put us at a longer term strategic disadvantage. So breaking up big tech alone doesn't solve our problem. Figuring out a way to incent them to, you know, to do better on behalf of all of us, and probably financial incentives are going to be the right way to go, while simultaneously making more of the systems interoperable, forcing parts of them to be, you know, public for code bases to be public. It doesn't detract from the bottom line. Like, we have to take a much more sophisticated approach. Alex earlier talked about a scalpel versus a hammer. And this is one of those, like, you know, the blunt instrument here is the hammer, right? That's breaking them up. The scalpel approach is going to serve us better in the longer term.
I don't know if this is something we can innovate our way out of, though. I mean,
the innovation is in policy, not it's. You know, these companies have become so politicized. And to be fair, it's their own fault. But if we, you know, because we have this is also sort of this hydra where we have systems and services that are not interoperable. We've got companies that are so big and wield so much economic might, they effectively act as nation states. I mean, for God's sake, Microsoft has its own corporate foreign policy group that it has poached from state.
Right.
So we have wicked, challenging problems sort of demand creative approaches.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're going to wind up in court arguing about all of this and going backwards.
Well, we're certainly going to do that. That's right, Alex. That's already a given. This is all.
We will be in court.
We will be.
There will be lawyers.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Leo, I think what you're getting at here, right? So there's two big questions that we have. One is how can we incentivize an environment of competition in our country so that these companies do not consolidate control in the way that they have, and that we have, you know, smaller firms that are able to come up and start, you know, taking a little bit of their market share and then maybe building bigger things as a result of it versus now where they don't have the ability to compete. And that's like, you know, definitely a worthy conversation. But I think this week what really demands to be foregrounded is how do we put our society back together, right? Because that's the issue that we've had with some of these platforms. And you've talked about it, how, you know, people end up going into their echo chambers and, you know, basically forming another version of reality that's disconnected with what's actually happening in the world.
I have family members I can't talk to because they operate on a different set of facts.
Exactly. And so when we talk about this discussion of, like, should we break up Facebook, I think or should we decentralize? I think we really need to think about the second order effects, which is that, you know, what network does take off and does it become a partisan network like a Gab?
And isn't there a tendency to that because of the network effect? I mean, right now people are saying WhatsApp, oh my God, Apple's revealed all the privacy issues. Let's all use Signal. It's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. Everybody you talk to is on WhatsApp. You're going to still use WhatsApp.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Signal is now the number one app in the App Store. So there's
a lot of people are trying it. Yeah, but
right, people are trying it.
If my family and friends aren't on it, I've done that. It's great. Love Signal. Nobody I know is on it.
Correct. Look, and I think we're getting at the same point, which is that we need to consider the second order effects and that history doesn't end with a ban because people, when you zap somebody off your social platform, you know, they don't just go away.
No.
They still have access.
They go to 8chan.
The browser. They might go somewhere else. And so actually, you know, if you think about Facebook, they've been slow and irresponsible for a large part of their history. So I think that, you know, rather than saying let's break Facebook up, I think we need to focus on some of the policies that Facebook could implement to end up bringing us back to that shared version of reality. They know how to structure their newsfeed, and Dan, I think, can back this up in a way that will, you know, not divide people by having them direct their clicks to partisan and sensationalized news. They can direct their newsfeed to a place where, you know, there are news organizations that have some sentiment or some attachment to the truth that people go to. And they can change the recommendation algorithms to make sure that, you know, people are not going to, they did this right before the election too, that people aren't going to groups that end up in the next conspiracy theory. We know many people, you know, did that and ended up finding their way to things like QAnon through Facebook recommendations. But what our society facing now is more than a technology problem, which is something I don't think should be lost in this discussion, right? Because, you know, while technology might have helped, you know, I hope that horse leave the barn, that horse is out. And I think a major part of this solution is we need a people part of this solution as well, where, you know, I'm hoping, and, you know, I think a realist will say this is unlikely, but the optimistic take is that maybe the fever breaks, you know, from an event like this.
Yeah.
And people realize that this stuff is just totally unacceptable. We have to preserve democracy, and that the elements of the country that, you know, led up or helped build up to, you know, what we experienced over the past week, you know, aren't given the free rein and the, oh, what could be the worst thing that happens perspective that we've had so far. We need people who are, you know, who are our political leaders or media leaders to steer us back to like a world where people can talk to each other. Like you should be able to talk to your relatives and to your friends and about politics. And okay, the part of the reason of that is we can't do that is because of tech. But, you know, these tech companies amplify people, and it's up to the people who are making these statements. They have a responsibility, you know, to step up to the game and realize how close we were to the disruption of the counting of the votes for the president of the United States. You know, potentially, who knows, they could have burned those votes if they got into the hall at the right time, and to steer us back from the brink. That's what we should demand from our leadership right now. And I think that's, you know, just as, if not more important as the technology solutions that we're seeking to implement.
I suppose you can look at certainly recent history as a pendulum swing back and forth. And each time the pendulum goes too far in one direction, it swings back in the other direction. I fear, though, that at some point it's going to swing so far it's going to get stuck.
Well, that and might be where we are right now.
I have a feeling we could be where we are right now. Boy, I feel like this is a very difficult thing to solve. And, you know, you can say that, Alex, that, oh, it's up to Facebook to fix their newsfeed. But that just says, in a way, well, it's up to Mark Zuckerberg to solve this.
That sure is. Yeah. I mean, that's the reality that we have.
That gives him a lot of power. That gives him a lot.
Yeah, but whether or not we like it, he has that power today.
That's true.
We need the help of the platforms in the short term. There's no question for short and medium term that they're going to have an outsized role, and we should be asking a lot of them. And Alex is exactly right. They could tweak the newsfeed tomorrow to do things that would be better for all of us, but possibly not as good for the bottom line at Facebook. And there's any number of things that they, Twitter, and other social media companies could do to help us improve the conversations and to make them more civil and to downgrade the BS and to upgrade things that have demonstrated some sort of, interest in truth and things like that. But we have to just put a lot of pressure on them. And even then, they're going to do what they decide.
Is it too simplistic of me, Amy, to say the problem is algorithms? And, you know, I think people, when they joined Facebook, a lot of people, I thought, oh, this is great. It's going to be me looking at a feed of the things my family and friends are doing. And that's that. I left Facebook because it pretty clearly became something other than that because of the evil algorithm. YouTube, the algorithm pushes people into extremism. Is it too simplistic to say, well, that's because the algorithm optimizes for profit, not for polity?
Right. So I'll answer that question. And then a note on YouTube. And then I actually just thought of a solution for Facebook.
Oh, good.
So
I knew if we let you think long enough, you'd solve this.
So my answer to your question, is it too simplistic to just blame it on the algorithms? The answer is no. That's exactly what the problem is. Now, it's not algorithmic determinism on its own. Humans still play a role. And both Alex and Dan have made this point clearly. There are plenty of interventions that would amount to small tweaks that may not shift the experience so drastically that would at least alleviate or let out some of the steam, right, from the pot that's boiling. So that's one thing. YouTube hasn't been brought up at all. And again, Trump has been the most visual and vocal presence on Facebook and on Twitter, and that's what gets talked about a lot. And I know Bannon got taken off of YouTube. The YouTube's personalization algorithms are far better than everybody else's, and I think deserves much more scrutiny than it's receiving. I would actually start there. I wouldn't start with Facebook and Twitter, but it'd be easy to tell Google
stop optimizing for profit, just stop it.
Okay, so that leads into the answer. So I was trying to think through, like, I'm always asking the question, what would it take for X to be Y? So I was thinking as I was listening to Alex and Dan, what would it take for these companies to change their minds? Or, you know, and the problem is that individuals, we often lump everybody together. There are plenty of people working at these companies who disagree with the policies of these companies, but their employees,
one of the stories this week is petitions by Twitter, Google, Facebook employees all saying, take down Trump. Whether that
well,
had any
and
impact,
got,
I don't know, but
I have some very good friends working at these companies who are there because they are trying to make a difference, which is why they stay. At any rate, what would it take for Facebook to take down the content that it knows is salacious in the newsfeed? And that's what led me to kind of an interesting idea, which is, it would be tedious, but not impossible to build many, many permutations of financial models that hinge on different variables. So for example, QAnon is kind of a big topic, but within that, and I haven't seen the data on this, but my assumption is there's probably, you know, 1,000 sub keywords related to QAnon that tend to get posted within. So if you built a regression, you would probably, at any rate, there's probably a bunch of data. So what would be interesting is to try to quantify what the value of that post is. What's the actual monetary value of posts that use, you know, X number of terms related to these incendiary terms, right? So QAnon, Antifa, you know, Trump, whatever. So going at the content versus the user. And then if you have those models built, you would be able to project how much actual loss there might be. And I wonder if, I mean, I'm sure there would be some loss, right? But if you were able to be, like if Facebook could be transparent and say, we built these economic models, there are plenty of quant funds that do this exact same thing. So they could partner with a quant fund to actually do this for them, but to build those models, run the scenarios, and then be able to say, listen, we're about, you know, in a couple of days, we're going to start policing. Policing is not the right word. We're going to start treating this content differently. And this is our projected impact on our bottom line. And we believe it's going to cost us X amount of dollars to do this. We're doing it because we believe it's for the best. I wonder, you know, and we're asking for investors to see the bigger picture here and to not, you know, I wonder if there, rather than everybody speculating, I wonder if there was an actual model built, and if they used a quant fund model to that idea to do it, and then they were totally transparent about the results and gave everybody time, you know, I wonder, and said like, this is, we're going to do this from now on. I bet that would help, not hurt them, and it might solve our problems. That was super complicated.
Love a good story. Yeah. Wall Street loves a good story, and that's a good story.
Yeah.
So that might be a really productive way to proceed.
Our show today brought to you by ExpressVPN. I think when we talk about a VPN, to you guys, you know what a VPN is, and you even know why you might want to use it for privacy, because internet service providers and carriers can see everything you're doing and often log it and sell it to marketers. We also do it for security, because that guy in the hoodie in the coffee shop, he also could see everything you do, and maybe he's got nefarious intent. You might even do it because it allows you to emerge onto the public internet at an IP address not associated with you in a country, maybe the one you don't live in. And so if you've watched everything on Netflix, and who hasn't by this time, but you like Doctor Who, you just fire up ExpressVPN. It's a single button. You say, I want to be in London right now. Then refresh Netflix. Suddenly all the Doctor Who episodes are available in Netflix UK or Netflix Japan, where you can watch as much anime as you can take. That's kind of cool. One of the reasons you can do this is because ExpressVPN invests in their network. They're in almost 100 countries, and they make sure that there are enough IP addresses. They rotate them enough so that your privacy is really protected, and they're fast enough. Look at this speed, so that you can watch HD video. In fact, a lot of us keep ExpressVPN running all the time. You could put it on your router, protect your whole home, and you won't even know that ExpressVPN is running. It is great for privacy. It's great for security. It's great for watching content. And I have to say, one of the things I really like, and the reason I recommend ExpressVPN, is it is fully private. There are free and inexpensive VPN providers that don't protect your privacy, that don't respect you. That's not ExpressVPN. And we know that because they get regular audits by PricewaterhouseCoopers, who check their privacy policy, make sure they live up to that. They even check this trusted server technology that ExpressVPN uses. When you use an ExpressVPN VPN server, wherever it is in the world, it spins up the trusted server, runs in RAM, can't write to hard drive, it's completely sandboxed, and when you leave, it goes away, pfft, so does every record of your visit. It's completely private. That's the kind of thing you really want. And PricewaterhouseCoopers says, yes, that works exactly as I just described it. It's probably why CNET, Wired, and so many other people say ExpressVPN is the number one VPN service out there. It's the only one I use. So stop handing over your personal data to ISPs and other tech giants who mine your activity, sell off your information, protect yourself with the only VPN I trust to keep me private online. Visit expressvpn.com/twit, expressvpn.com/twit. Get an extra 3 months free with a 1-year package. It is the way to go. expressvpn.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of This Week in Tech, and thank you for supporting us by using that URL. They've got a 30-day money-back guarantee, too. I should throw that in so you know that no risk trying it out. ExpressVPN. Dan, somebody in the chat room brought this up. What if we brought back the fairness doctrine? Would that solve the media problem, the news problem?
No. it's so completely inadequate and wrong for the internet age that it was never my favorite thing, even when it existed with a limited number of broadcasters, which is what it was about.
Right.
It was a presumption that the airways are a limited quantity owned by the public, therefore they have responsibility, and we're going to make sure they do this. It was always a good idea in a sort of conceptual way, but hard to make work. But when you have, even with all the power of the big companies, there's still a lot of ways to be heard and to speak. And the idea that a fairness doctrine is somehow needed again seems crazy to me, especially because, you know, you have billions of things posted every day on Facebook. What are you going to do? Go in and try to
It's from an earlier era when there was just two points of view, Republican or Democrat, and you just balance it.
And, of course, that's one reason that traditional media earned a lot of the suspicion that has fallen upon them in the last couple of generations, is that the notion that there were two balanced and equally valid viewpoints for anything has always been kind of loony. And people who had views that were outside of those constrained right center and left center places had no outlet, no one talking to them. And, you know, I'm, to put it mildly, not a fan of Rush Limbaugh, but he filled a major gap in the media ecosystem, did it in an evil way, but there
did
was
it so well
that
he changed
he
talk radio
to.
Forever.
He sure did.
So.
I loathe what he did, but I recognize that he had filled a gap that was just huge, and no one's done that very well on the left. But their whole point is that I don't like constrained media ecosystems. I like the ability of people to publish, to say what they want to say, and to possibly reach an audience, rather than having to filter through a couple of or three or at most four networks run by old white men. That's crazy.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. Corporate media is not doing anybody a favor.
Leo, could I just jump in with
an
idea?
Sure, and then I'm going to take a break. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. One thing I've been standing on the table at with big technology is that we're never going to solve anything if we look only at the outputs, and we need to really look at the machine, which means that it's so easy to look at a bad post or a user you don't like and say, if you hit the ban button or if you remove this from your service, you're going to solve all the problems. Yeah. And that's why I think, like, over the past weekend, you know, so many people celebrating the ban of Donald Trump as if it's the end of all problems in the world are misguided. I think what we really need to do is to kind of look at how these platforms operate. And that can be the newsfeed algorithm. I mean, we did see ahead of the election, Facebook and Twitter basically showed us exactly, you know, what they believe is wrong with their service. But, you know, for one reason or another, they don't think is possible to make change permanently. So they did start directing people in the newsfeed to fact-based reporting. This was a noted newsfeed change that they announced where they thought it would, you know, be there'd be less tension. So, you know, if they have the more of the outrageous stuff, they might get more engagement, which is good for their business model. But for some reason, they decided to switch it back after the election, which to me was remarkable. They turned off group recommendations. So we know that that's an issue, because if they're trying to have a normal political system and they turn off group recommendations, what does that tell us about group recommendations? And then finally, I don't think there's been anywhere close to enough discussion of the damage that's done by the share button and the retweet button, which allows information to travel at lightning speed, you know, through these networks. That, number one, means misinformation is going to go quickly. But number two, it changes the way that people pass along information, because when you don't need to hesitate, when you just hit a button and you can share to people, you're going to share the thing, like you mentioned, that confirms or validates your belief and plays to emotion and not to thought. And there are studies that show that when you pause, you take a moment to think about what you're sharing, you're going to share things based off of whether they make sense for your followers, not in terms of, or your friends, not in terms of based off of how they make you feel. Yeah. And I think this entire instinctual, emotional-based sharing, where people are willing to share something that says, you know, Hillary Clinton is a space alien because it sort of validates their thoughts about Hillary Clinton, that is incredibly damaging. And if you have to copy and paste that into the compose box and actually put your avatar next to it, not somebody else's, it's a completely different calculation. But for some reason, whenever we have these discussions, we leave that completely out. And I think that if there's one thing we're going to do moving forward is we start to focus on the machine, especially the share and the retweet button, but also the recommendations and the algorithm itself. And that will probably get us into a much better place than thinking about who we're going to ban or what content we don't want on the platforms.
I agree.
Can I ask you a really quick question, Alex? And I know you've got to do commercial, but what if Twitter no longer showed externally metrics? So you knew how many followers you had, but you could not visually see anybody else's followers or the number of likes or retweets. If you took the extra step to go into your dashboard and see what got retweeted and liked, but basically all those metrics were stripped out of public view. I wonder if that seems like a tweak that could potentially help. Maybe.
Yeah, that is something that's absolutely worth testing. I mean, the way that these platforms make these decisions is they test with a limited number of users and they see how that impacts the way their service works. And if they like the results, then they roll it out. And to me, it's extraordinary that they haven't tested what you're talking about in particular. We already seen actually a version of this where Instagram stopped publicly displaying likes. And I think that changed. I mean, obviously, they decided to roll it out permanently, so they like what it was going. But it didn't kill the business. And it certainly changed the experience, where all of a sudden, you're not feeling bad about how many likes you get every time you post. And it's not about measuring up. It's about the
experience. Or more to the point, you're not retweeting simply because you see a bunch of people retweeting and you feel if you remove that incentive, I don't think that changes the it'd be interesting. I wonder if Twitter just did that for a couple of weeks, what would... I don't think that changes the...
Twitter did introduce the... Yeah. You haven't read that yet.
Right.
Warning.
doing is... That's like everybody's like, kidding.
Not only that, they also stopped the native retweet ahead of the election. But they said, people retweeted less, so that experiment didn't work. So they put it back.
Nice.
But like, come on.
Wrong metric.
Saying that every single decision they make is based off of the health of the platform, conversational health. Right. And it's really freaking interesting that when they evaluated how well that experiment worked, they didn't say whether it improved or hurt conversation health. Right. They said, well, people retweeted less.
Right.
It sort of goes to show you exactly what's going on inside that platform. Yep. It's about the incentives to keep engagement up and not about the incentives to make the conversation healthy.
Precisely.
And we're letting
problem.
Them off the hook.
Yeah.
Dan's been trying to get a word in edgewise.
Hold on a sec. Go ahead, Dan.
I
think the idea of putting a whole bunch of speed bumps into the process of sharing and posting is a great one. And they should, as Alex said, be A/B testing this like crazy. There's no evidence I've seen that they are. But there's all sorts of things that they should be experimenting with. And I think that the Twitter experiment was quite successful from a social point of view, not obviously from a business one. And Facebook's ability to change things pretty quickly is extraordinary. And the thing is that if what I've been arguing or trying to nudge Facebook toward personally is give users more control over their own news feed and give us dashboards to make some of our own decisions. And this is the usual answer is, oh, no one will do that. Well, why don't you try? I think we have so much help that we need from the platforms, and as yet not nearly enough being provided, but I'm hopeful, it's perfectly possible.
I'm hopeful that the government scrutiny is going to make them sit back and think, well, okay, maybe we do need to do some of these things, even if it doesn't increase engagement. Maybe that's not the only metric. Maybe not getting broken up by the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Antitrust, that would be a good goal as well. Amy, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think it's worth noting, especially given who we are each talking to today, you know, Twitter by volume is a fraction of Facebook. Their share value is a fraction of Amazon, of Apple. Twitter
and their usership is a fraction of it too.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. By any way you slice it, market cap, number of users, you know, the amplification in Twitter happens because there's a concentration of people in tech, politics, media. And media.
Yeah.
I think that is worth thinking through, because Twitter as a company is not what I would call I'm looking at their share price right now. They're not, you know, that's not the place where I would sink a bunch of money into. And yet they have this unbelievable influence. And I think the insight there is that this isn't platform alone, but it's people. I mean, you know, as much as Twitter is enabling misinformation to spread, people in positions of power are helping them do that.
Yeah.
I am guilty of the same. You know, I have certainly spread incendiary content more than once without really thinking through how others in my network are going to treat that information. So all of us bear some responsibility here. The platforms are making poor choices that are in response to market demands, but we're all complicit in this.
There's no Twitter user that hasn't regret tweeted at some point or the other.
I mean, I like how Maggie Haberman calls it a anger video game, where retweets are the points.
Yeah.
And I think there's some real truth to that.
Yeah. It's really set up that way. All right. Let's take a little break, only because we have to. But this is a great conversation. It will continue with our wonderful guests. First time on, Alex, but I'm really glad to have you on. We'll have you back lots more. Alex Kantrowitz, bigtechnology.substack.com, and the Big Technology Podcast. Old friend Dan Gilmore, who is, of course, a great guy to listen to in all of this stuff. Longtime media watcher, dangilmore.com, at Dang Ilmore on the Twitter. And and Amy Webb, the future is talking at the Future Today Institute. Wait a minute, let me just shake the what should we do about Facebook Future Today Institute magic 8-ball? It says maybe small bets. I don't like it. I want another one. Call FTI. I like that one. Our show today. Before we start the ad, I just want to mention it is survey time. We do this at the beginning of every year. We don't collect information about you. We're not able to. We don't want to. We know you don't want us to. But advertisers want to know. We want to know what you're interested in, what you like, how much money you make, things like that, your education level. So we do this survey once a year, completely voluntary. You don't have to answer any question if you don't want to. But it is very helpful for us. It'll take about, I don't know, 5, 10, 15 minutes of your time. Depends on how much you think about the answers. twit.tv/survey21. We really appreciate it if you take that survey. Thank you. I don't want to just kind of, you know, beat a dead horse. That seems rude. I don't want to keep going on this subject if we've said everything that needs to be said. It's clearly a thorny issue.
There's breaking news.
Oh, no.
There's actually...
Now what?
Yeah. So this is kind of interesting. Just as we've all been talking, Stripe is no longer Stripe is canceled Trump, so they're not taking any more payments. So that's kind of interesting, right? Because that's the social media infrastructure has to do with information, and that's important. But gutting the architecture of what make these websites work and able to collect money, that I think is a bigger problem for wow. Trump than being pulled off of Facebook and Twitter. They're not going to be able to process payments.
That's the Pornhub punishment. Yep. If you can't use credit cards
right.
on a site, that really, that's actually more significant than getting pushed off Twitter or Facebook. That means you can't raise money.
Yeah, and it's interesting. So does that, I kind of would be interested to get Dan and Alex's take on this, but could we say that is information, is a digital payment? Does that fall within the realm of information?
I feel like that's something the Supreme Court could weigh in on and say, you know what, that is a violation. That is a First Amendment. Well, it's not First Amendment because it's not government. But you're taking away this guy's right to raise money in a political campaign. Talk about, you know, destroying a campaign. What if they did that to the next person running for president? That's a big deal. What do you think, Alex?
I mean, like, these are, you know, Stripe isn't the only payment processor off. I think it would be much more impactful if, let's say, Visa or MasterCard.
Well,
said,
I wonder if they'll follow.
I mean, now
the
question goes to
they also did. Just did.
They did,
just
too.
While
they're
we've been
out
talking.
As well.
So Citibank, they're no longer accepting money from any PACs. So they're not specifically targeting Republicans or Trump, but they are no longer accepting any money for the time being for PACs.
With the Citizens United
companies, you can still use a credit card to donate to Trump.
Can you?
If he moves to a new software.
Yeah, I mean, they would have to re-engineer their site and get off of Stripe and onto something else.
I want to call it the death knell to the campaign and to his ability to raise money. It's a temporary situation. I mean, even with Gab, you saw Gab was able to build its own servers, and it's running today.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think in the 24 hours after the storming of the Capitol, they had 2.2 million visits, according to the head of the site told me while I was working on a story for Big Technology about that. So, like, these are setbacks, but it's not like, you know, him, you know, Trump not being on Twitter or on Facebook isn't the end of his ability to communicate. He could
at a certain point
set up his own website with his own servers and communicate that way, similar with the payment processing. But it is, you know, it is definitely a setback and will take time for them to work through.
Yeah, I do recommend your latest Substack newsletter where you talk about alternative social networks. As Trump gets banned from mainstream networks, there are many places like Gab that are still there. And boy, some of the stuff posted on these sites is horrific.
Well, these are the second order effects. And by the way, Gab's CEO said he had a phone call with a very special person yesterday.
Didn't say
who that was.
Yeah.
But given that Parler is going down and, like, the only other option might be Telegram or some other secondary networks, I would not be surprised to see a big migration to Gab, which is already set up outside of the tech giant's control largely. So keep an eye out for that.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, the Supreme Court in the Citizens United did say money is speech. So if you cut off the air supply for a political campaign, you're cutting off their speech.
I think it's you know, your ability to spend money to support a cause is speech. Your ability
to collect,
to raise money through a specific platform.
Interesting. Yeah,
I don't believe it's speech.
Okay, very interesting. Thank you, Amy, for that breaking news. Holy cow! We live in interesting times. Not necessarily a good thing.
You know, we talk about the platform power. What about the power of just a small number of payment systems to decide who's allowed to make money?
Exactly. Yeah.
And WikiLeaks was basically very close to shut down back in the days when it was before 2016. I'm not a fan of what they've done recently, but they were doing something important for a long time. And were essentially taken out of the fundraising world by companies that had no, you know, they didn't really answer to anybody except somebody calling them from Washington saying, we'd really like you to take WikiLeaks off of your systems. That's pretty dangerous, too.
Yeah. On a brighter note, it is the 20th anniversary of Wikipedia, which, I mean, if you're going to point to one thing that the internet does well, that's the one, right?
I don't think so.
No, I thought, geez, you know, fraught with peril letting the community edit an encyclopedia, but you think,
yeah,
I mean,
well,
isn't Wikipedia an amazing poster child for crowdsourced internet?
Not when you're being targeted for harassment. Oh. Brianna Wu and I can both give you long stories of how I didn't establish my Wikipedia page. I don't know who did. I can tell you that it's thankfully, and I love everybody listening, so I know you are not going to go in and start monkeying around with it again. But after my first book came out, there was quite a bit of back and forth and like vandalism, you know, and I mean, just really bad, like really horrible stuff that was being posted. And there's no, like, I'm the source. I am the primary source. Could I at least take that stuff off?
No, you don't get to edit your page. Can. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Never mind. I like it, but then I haven't had too much vandalism. There's been a little bit, but nothing too malicious. I feel like Wikipedia, well, all right, never mind. I'll take that back.
I think it's a great idea. I think there are ways to improve, yeah. And there's got, you know, so that it is not, so when you are in a situation and people are targeting you in some way, that it is not impossible to deal with.
So I don't disagree with any of that, and I think Wikipedia is a miracle that gets better and better and better, and we it can always improve, and people running it are aware of a lot of these issues. Maybe don't move as fast as we would like them to on some things, but man, I think the world would be vastly worse off without Wikipedia than what we have with it.
I love it. But I didn't know about all that abuse you and Brianna had, so that's not so good. Our show today brought to you by Mint Mobile. I got my my iPhone SE from Mint Mobile. This is an amazing deal. The SE is $15 a month. My Mint Mobile, unlimited nationwide talk and text and data. I think I get the 3 gigs of data a month. $15. So the total package, $30 a month. That's amazing. One of the ways Mint Mobile does it, they don't have stores. They don't spend money renting stores. They don't have storefronts. It's an all online wireless service selling you the same service you get with a premium wireless plan, but starting at $15 a month. That is an amazing deal. All their plans come with unlimited talk and text and high speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network, T-Mobile. You can use your own phone, bring your own phone. They'll send you a SIM free. You put it in the phone. You keep your contacts. They'll even port your old phone number over. They also sell phones like that iPhone SE. What a great price. And if you're not 100% satisfied, Mint Mobile has you covered with their 7-day money back guarantee. Switch now to Mint Mobile. Get premium wireless service starting at just $15 a month. Actually, I liked it so much because I'm a T-Mobile customer. I thought, you know, why am I paying $70-$80 a month for something I can get for less? I ended up paying $300 for a year of Mint Mobile for 12 gigabytes a month. That's $25 a month for 12 gigabytes, unlimited nationwide talk and text. That's a great deal. Here's what you do. Go to mintmobile.com/twit, pick the plan you like, and stop paying all those huge phone bills. I feel like every phone I use should be Mint Mobile. Why am I paying more? Mintmobile.com/twit. Cut your wireless bill to as low as $15 a month and get the plan shipped to your door for free. Mintmobile.com/twit. This is an idea whose time has come, I think. Mintmobile.com/twit. Thank you, Mint Mobile, for supporting the show. Okay, how about this? The iPhone, 13 years old, at least the announcement of the iPhone, 13 years ago this weekend. Who hates the iPhone here? Anybody? Okay.
I don't use Apple stuff, so.
Okay. Well, that's, right. Yeah, but your Android phone is based on the iPhone. So, you know, I mean, it's basically a copy of the iPhone. So.
You want to hear a great story about the iPhone announcement?
Yeah. Were you there? I was there.
I was not there, but I can tell you who heard about the iPhone at the same time that I did. It was the executive leaders at BlackBerry.
Oh, dear. How did they react to that? Did they say, oh, we're in trouble?
Rumor has it. It's a wonderful story. Rumor has it. So the CEO at the time was supposedly on a treadmill. And the others came in and said, you're never going to believe this. And they're trying to explain this iPhone. They see the commercial. And when they finally got their hands on one, they cracked it open and said, my God, it's a computer.
Yeah.
And still refused to see a future in which a phone would be something more than for office email and calendars. Yes. And people would respond to something without buttons. That was purely haptic.
It really is amazing how the reaction of BlackBerry, Microsoft, and others really underplayed what was about to happen. Clearly a revolution in hindsight, we know, a revolution in computing, maybe the most significant revolution since the personal computer. It killed BlackBerry, essentially. In fact, my last phone before my first iPhone in 2007 was a BlackBerry Pearl. Loved that physical keyboard and all that, but I never bought another one after that, and I think I'm not alone. Apple will probably attempt the same thing in a couple of years. I have a feeling Hyundai may have made a strategic mistake by announcing that they were talking with Apple about making a car. Apple's not notoriously forgiving in cases like that. Hyundai's stock went up 19%. And then they kind of retracted, saying, oh, Apple's in discussion with a lot of automakers. It's not just us. But it's interesting because we've heard the drumbeat about Apple making a car now suddenly ramp up over the last couple of weeks. So this Hyundai story is kind of interesting. Clearly, Apple doesn't have manufacturing capability to manufacture a car. They'd have to go to somebody who makes cars. But an Apple car is an interesting product. Probably not till 2024 or 2025, maybe later, depending on which rumor mill you listen to. I want to see Tim Cook on stage saying, it's an internet communicator. It's a phone. It's a transportation device. Internet communicator, phone, transportation device.
And being Apple, they'll decide where you go.
Yes, that's right. It is presumed to be an electric vehicle, self-driving probably. Unclear when you'd have it. Of course, Apple's not commenting. Also, strong rumors that Apple and Facebook will do augmented reality glasses of some kind this year. Facebook's already kind of in that business, having bought Oculus. There have been significant rumors that perhaps, Andrew Bosworth of Facebook says it's smart glasses that they're building in relationship with Ray-Ban will arrive sooner than later and will not necessarily be... Oh, my God. Now, I'm trying to go to this story on Bloomberg, and Bloomberg has decided I'm a robot. So I'm clicking this, I'm not a robot, and it still thinks I'm a robot. Bloomberg, I was going to give you a nice plug for that story. I'm not a robot, Bloomberg. You see, the robots have really taken over. They really
have.
The
robots have totally taken over, that's for sure.
Amy, what'd you think of the dancing dog and the Boston Dynamics robots doing ballet moves?
So I will tell you, I watch a lot of robots. I certainly thought that was funny. I showed it to my daughter, and who loves ballet and robots, and thought it was really cool. And then, for some reason, I remembered Peanut Butter Jelly Time. Do you guys remember that?
Yeah,
meme?
Peanut Butter Jelly Time.
So I was
time.
Like, So I was like, oh, wouldn't it be funny if the Boston Dynamics robot did something with that? And I went from this video to that GIF and song, and she was like, old, you're weird old technology stuff.
She was not at all interested in Peanut Butter Jelly
Time. She was
time.
Not amused.
No. But did she enjoy the robots? New. Yeah.
She thought that it was not real. She thought that it was some kind of CGI or animation.
See, that's the problem with her generation. They're never going to know what's real or not because everything.
I thought it was. No, the fact that she was skeptical, I thought was amazing.
Good.
She didn't just see this and thought it was. I mean, I was so proud. was like, great.
And she wasn't brought up on, you know, Terminator movies. And so she didn't look at this and go, oh, my God, we're all it's done. We're done. We're through. It's over.
She's still pretty young. So we haven't explored
this. Yeah. See, I see this robot bearing arms and dancing its way over to me. And I find it a little bit scary. Oh, my God. It's got a jaw. It's got a mouth. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It can't open up a door. So.
Yeah, it can. That's why the jaw is there. It can turn
the
knob. Yeah.
I've seen a lot of robot fails of it trying to actually.
Oh, sure. We humans reassure ourselves by pretending that it can't open a door.
It'll get there if it's not there yet.
Yeah.
Who needs to be able to open a door when you're holding a 50 caliber?
Exactly. There are other ways to open those doors. Actually, this is amazing that this 350-pound device can stand on one leg and balance is pretty impressive. I have to say.
This is, I think, partly designed to make people feel better after they saw the robot in Singapore, going after people for not wearing masks. Mm-hmm. You know, that sort of freaked a lot of people out. Mm-mm. Mm-mm.
Mm-mm. It's all scary. What the hell is
so
that?
So why is robot... Why is Boston Dynamics, why are they having such a hard time finding a, they keep getting acquired and unacquired.
Yeah. So Google owned them. And then Google probably wisely decided having killer military robots was not a good part in the portfolio. So they sold it to SoftBank, and SoftBank just sold it as well.
Well, SoftBank's Hyundai, right? All kinds of issues.
Yeah. Didn't they go to Hyundai?
Yeah, I think you might be right.
Maybe they're going to Hyundai to work on this.
Maybe
Apple
it's the
car,
Apple robot.
Which, by the way, I
maybe Apple's
having having reported on Apple and spoken with the engineers who've worked on that car, I don't think that thing's going to happen. I don't think that's ever going to roll off the assembly line. Period.
That's a big deal to get in the car business. Although, who's the richest man in the world right now?
Yeah,
Elon Musk. That's bizarre. He made $37 billion last week to suddenly...
And sadly doesn't have a home.
He's homeless because he got rid of his home. And his child is named something unpronounceable.
He has several children. That's not the... Right? Doesn't he
he has adult children.
Five?
Yeah.
He's got... Yeah.
But he is worth $188 billion on paper. And... When he said you should use Signal, what happened, Alex?
Signal became number one.
Through the roof.
It's almost as if Elon has a little bit of influence among people who are interested in emerging technology.
Yeah. I don't know. I owned a Tesla for a while, but it was kind of like that Boston Dynamic robot. I felt like my wife at one point, Lisa said, this car is in beta and I don't trust it. It's going to kill me. It would be veering off the highway and the door, it had those gull wing doors that kept closing on her head because they never put sensors on the bottom part. So it was very careful to open them and not hit the wall. But if you had your head underneath, it would stand back. So I, at some point in my Model X, I had to announce the doors are closing. Stand clear, stand clear.
I just bought an Audi, e-tron Sportback.
Oh, did you? I'm so jealous.
Yeah, it's like driving a spaceship. It's much bigger than I thought it was going to be. The electronics are there are lots of features and functions. But ultimately, it's got like a permanent nanny state. If I put cruise control on, you know, and I set it 5 to 10 miles above the speed limit, every time its computer vision senses a new speed limit sign, it will slow the car back down to what is stated.
Oh, interesting.
There's really, you can't easily override all of the following the rules features, which
it's
I find
pretty
annoying.
I was thinking of getting one.
That's a perfect example of something that you bought that you don't own.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I bought, well, and I also didn't buy it. I don't buy cars. I lease them. But and it's the amount of data that it wants to collect is pervasive.
Oh, God,
it
yes.
wants all, yeah, which I said no to. So
Tesla started
that. Makes
that
it a little bit more.
Early
difficult.
On when we got the Tesla, I could have sworn I was in reverse, but the car went forward. And it happened a couple of times, once to me, once to my wife. So we called Tesla, and they said, well, according to the log, you were in drive.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Yeah, oh, yeah, we know exactly what you do.
They control the log production. They control, I mean, you know, you have to trust them on that.
Yeah,
and
yeah. There's no opting out.
You know, cars, of course, have had black boxes for a long time before Tesla. So the data stuff is going back a fairly long time. And it is pervasive and it's disgusting.
Yeah.
That said, if you want an all-electric vehicle, which I wanted, there's not a lot. And I wasn't going to buy the...
I'm getting the Mustang, baby.
The Fisker.
No, don't get the Fisker.
No.
No, I don't. No, get the Fisker. It's not the scissor company.
It's not ready.
It's not ready.
But this e-tron is, Leo, you actually might like it a lot if you guys are in the market.
Well, I'm getting a Mustang Mach-E any day now, mm-hmm. but I think maybe the GT is beautiful.
It's
a nice car.
I love that car.
That's what the Porsche Taycan is based on.
Yeah. This Audi is really underpowered. I think, here's a tech-related thing. We have yet to solve the battery issue, and because the battery capacity on these things, that's I think the big, big advantage that Tesla has over everybody else, the battery. The range on this Audi is only 150 miles, and it's drastically underpowered. It has the space for a bigger, I mean, an engine is, you don't need more space, right? So it could have a bigger, better engine in it. But the battery won't support it. And the battery technology is a lot of what's holding back I think, explosion of EVs.
Yeah. John Lasseter, the director at Pixar, had a Fisker, one of the early ones. And I remember his wife told me, don't get it. We drove up to the Academy Awards and we couldn't get out because the car had malfunctioned. So we had to roll down the windows and climb out. So again, it's probably incredible. Not a good choice. There's a car, a story of a car gone wild.
This I finally, during the pandemic, finally caved and bought a car. I hadn't owned a car in a decade or so.
What do you need one in a pandemic for? You're not going anywhere, Alex.
Well, the point is, yeah, I mean, you're not going to take... I was taking public transportation everywhere.
And you don't want to do that. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Uber. And yeah. I was like, all right.
Yeah.
So I went back to the future. 2007, Mazda Miata, got it from someone
perfect.
In San Francisco.
Perfect.
And it's been a blast and a pleasure.
And that car does not log your presence at all. There's no-
as far as we know. It's,
I'm pretty
it's,
sure.
About as technologically dumb as it gets. We'll see how long it lasts.
I love those. When those came out.
164,000 miles.
Yeah, that's good. It's what you want.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a beater.
That's right. It's a beater.
It's a good-looking beater.
You're being logged by others in the Bay Area anyway.
Yeah, that's true. There's cameras.
I also have an iPhone everywhere. In the car while I'm driving, so maybe I'm helping Apple with that Apple Car development.
The car is the least, honestly, the car tracking me is the absolute least of my concerns. I've got, we're all surrounded by so much technology, there is no way not to be surveilled.
It always cracks me up. I had a guy call. He was an older gentleman on the radio show today, a lot older. He said, my Yahoo weather doesn't remember my favorite places. And I've said, what browser are you using? He says, I'm using Firefox. And he apparently, because the news site that he read had too many ads, he turned on cookie blocking, which
good
of course has nothing to do with ads. But
smart idea.
Yeah, people are, that cookie thing. And then, I got to point out, if you're carrying a smartphone, you're carrying a device that has built-in GPS and always-on internet connection, a microphone and a camera, and in my case, LiDAR, that's the perfect spy device.
Yeah.
Who cares what cookies? Who cares?
Yeah.
Who cares? Hey, let's take another little break. We have a little video. Fun week this week on Twit. We've combined some of the highlights to make this little movie for your enjoyment. Watch.
So today was fun because Mulch Fest, you bring your Christmas tree.
Oh.
And they have huge machines.
Oh, that's great.
And they run it through, and you can bring a shopping bag.
They give you a bag of mulch?
In December, it's really hard to reassemble it. But but it takes up
so much space. It's much more compact.
To store it.
Previously on Twit. Security Now. swatting goes IoT. The FBI wrote, to warn users of smart home devices with cameras and voice capabilities to use complex, unique passwords and enable two-factor authentication to help protect against swatting attacks.
This Week in Google.
Reverse engineering the source code. Yes, source code of the Pfizer COVID vaccine. And it is fascinating.
Wait, why does the vaccine have a source code?
That's what's fascinating.
Okay.
All about Android.
This is a remake of the Commodore 64 called VC64. This just gives me so much joy. I've actually literally played hours of it since I've had it. That's how like geeked out I am on this thing. So
TWiT. Or if you're on a Commodore 64, it's TWiT, 8, 1.
Don't forget to use the peak command. I suppose we should probably talk about Section 230. I don't really, it's like TikTok. It's like as the Trump presidency winds down, I wonder, there's these little things kind of hanging out in the world, like TikTok was supposed to be shut down. I don't think it's going to be shut down. Although maybe now that it banned the president, it will be. I don't know. I also feel like all of the attacks on Section 230, they've just kind of gone up in smoke. Even Ajit Pai, the current chairman of the FCC on his last days, has said, I'm not going to do anything about Section 230. Section 230, as some have said, is the 23 words that created the internet. 60 Minutes did a piece on it a couple of weeks ago that was completely wrong, got it completely wrong, which is a shame. If you want to know more about Section 230, read Mike Masnick's Tector, where he explains what it means. But it is really very simple. It means that, well, there's really two parts. No provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. In other words, you can't be sued. Twitter, Facebook can't be sued for anything other people post. I can't be sued for things people post on my chat room. I can't be sued for things people post in our forums or comments on our webpage. Even though I run those sites, I'm not liable for what people post there. If you got rid of that, I'd have to take the chat room down. I'd have to take the forums down. I'd have to take comments down because I don't want to be liable for something somebody says on those sites. I think it's pretty clear we need Section 230. Is it at risk? Anybody have any thoughts on this?
I don't think it's at risk at all. I think we should cut through some of the bullcrap, which is that the Republicans have been threatening to revoke Section 230 because they don't like the way they've been moderated. And that's why you see every time there's a label put on Trump's tweets, back when he was able to tweet, he would tweet Section 230, revoke Section 230, because they didn't want the platforms to be touching their stuff.
But that was a complete misunderstanding of what 230
is. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Total misunderstanding. Yeah. But they knew, they know, they're lawmakers. They know exactly what the law, maybe except for Trump, they had a good idea of what that law was supposed to do. The threat of revoking it was supposed to intimidate these platforms to not touch their content. Because like you said, if Section 230 went away, you'd have to take down their chat room. It's not a pretty world for if you're Facebook or you're Google and Section 230 is gone. And now all of a sudden you're liable for everything that's posted. So essentially this was a toothless death threat that people who didn't like the way that these companies were moderating content, that was like what they would hold above their head. But now we're moving into a world where the Democrats control the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives. And you'll note that very few of them have come out and said we need to, either revoke or amend this law. So for the next 2 years at least, but probably longer, there is not a high likelihood of anything happening to 230. And honestly, I feel sometimes like I'm the only person who's like, this is actually a good law because you shouldn't hold companies liable for, what's said by other people on their forums online, assuming that they you know, do some form of good faith content moderation to keep, you know, illegal things like child porn off of their sites.
In fact, it gives you the right to moderate as well.
Exactly.
Which is really important. You don't want to take away Twitter's right to moderate.
Exactly right. And so to me, I think that we're about to see the end of this bad faith use of holding Section 230 over these platforms' head to have them lay off the partisan, you know, either party's messaging. I think that's over.
Yeah.
May I vehemently disagree with what Alex just said?
Oh, good. Yes.
Of course.
We found somebody who hates Section 230.
He said Democrats, basically don't care. I'll tell you two Democrats who have come out and said in one case that he would repeal it completely. That is the president-elect.
Yes.
Biden specifically called out 230 for repeal. And the soon-to-be vice president led a campaign in California to a cynical campaign in California to carve a giant hole in Section 230, charging people with things she knew were legal, despite.
Oh, I did not know about this.
I'll send you some info on that. I think the Democrats are.
This was when she was
anything more
state
likely
AG.
To poke a hole in it than the Republicans were, because Alex is absolutely right that the Republicans had no idea what it did or purported not to. But I think the Democrats are at least as big a danger in this case. And the thing that's important to keep in mind, this is not a law written to protect Twitter and Facebook and Google, which didn't exist at the time the law was written. It's a law written to promote free speech. That's the point of the law. And we keep losing that in the debate that's not really a debate. So I'm exceedingly worried. And we almost lost it this time because of, you know, it can easily be tossed into some omnibus legislation because Congress doesn't pass like individual laws anymore. I think we're in real danger and very soon.
Harris,
real danger
was
of what? The
losing
the,
it
of Section 230 being repealed or gutted.
Harris, when she was California Attorney General, was going after the revenge porn industry, which honestly is a good thing, but
something
the way
worth going after,
yeah, but the way she was doing it
was
to peel away the legal protections that keep online platforms immune, and that was misguided, to say the least. It was the wrong direction to take, even though it was a popular position, a position I agree with. I think that's the wrong way to go about it. I believe that Biden's anti-230 comments were offhand. And Jeff Jarvis says that he's talked to people who have been advising the Biden transition, that they have talked with him and explained why that's a bad idea. So it remains to be seen. I think both Harris and Biden, you know, clearly acted against 230 in the past, but let's hope cooler heads prevail.
Yeah, that's my response to Dan. I think there are things you say as a candidate, and then it's a completely different ballgame when you're actually there at running the country and you speak with, you know, your congressional leaders who have been doing something different
Is it reasonable to say, as some have said, well, that's obviously we don't want to repeal it, but maybe it needs to be fixed,
strengthened?
What? How would you strengthen it, Amy?
So again, the central challenge we have in our democracy is that our laws are not responsive, meaning we can't recalibrate them. We have to create a new law to mitigate the problems in interpreting that law, given the changing, like, right. So and our system is set up to not have a lot of gray area, and you want to know what's acceptable and not acceptable. So if Section 230 doesn't exist or is weakened in some way, And also, everybody wants the big tech companies to be broken up or to create a situation where there is profound competition, meaning there are lots of niche, you know, microsites and lots more distribution of content, then all of those brand new organizations become vulnerable,
right?
Because they're going to be tiny. They're not going to have, they're not going to be lawyered up. And if somebody tries to sue them, right. So
Facebook is a, in other problem. Words, Facebook is a little bit safer.
Facebook's fine
because it
Facebook's
has
totally
enough resources to fight those kinds of actions. It would be all
that's
the
right.
all the startups trying to replace Facebook. That
that's
would...
exactly right, Mike. So again, we can't look at any of these issues in a vacuum. We have to look at all of these as levers that you know, the push pull of the levers at, on how our democracy works, because all of these, you know, repealing, not repealing, strengthening, weakening, they all have these reverberating next order effects, which could impact some of the very same things that people are fighting, you know, fighting over at just adjacently related areas.
Well, trust me, if this comes back to haunt us, we will be talking about it and fighting to save it, because I'm of the opinion that without 230, it'd be very hard to for us to go forward. And we'd certainly have to shut down all public comment on all the things we do. And that's a big deal, because I can't, unlike Mark Zuckerberg, I can't really afford to fight a lawsuit.
It's a really important point that you and Amy make. When we had GDPR roll out, there was this, you know, view that it was going to apply equally. But of course, the bigger tech companies are the ones that had the amount of resources necessary to be able to comply with that law. And that's privacy law in Europe. So what you ended up having was, you know, Facebook and Google worked fine in Europe. But if you try to go to some of the local news sites or smaller news sites, they just shut down in Europe because they couldn't operate there. So considering the second order effects here is extremely important. Yeah. And I'm glad we've discussed it.
Yeah.
If new laws entrench the people that we're worried about, that's obviously something to reconsider.
The opposite of what we've been talking about on this show. Yeah. Somebody said I should start twit.ru. That's not a bad idea.
You can go over with Parler to the cloud servers.
Actually, we had a very irate person who was, I think, kicked out of chat. He said something stupid about George Floyd and was kicked out of chat, which we have every right to do. And Section 230 protects us. He said, I'm going to sue you. I said, dude, go ahead, because of Section 230. If there's no Section 230, I have to take that very, very seriously. And so no more banning in chat. No more. None of that. Everything goes. Oh, boy. I would shut it down immediately. Actually, I've already taken I shouldn't admit this. I've already taken steps to distance chat. We no longer run the server. It's not on our servers. It's community run, which is good. So I'm putting it at arm's length, and it's partly because of that. I don't.
Are you talking about the IRC?
Yeah.
Mm.
Mm. I love them, but I don't want to go to jail for it.
Yeah.
I mean, it just goes to show you that running a forum or running a business with user-generated content is probably one of the more difficult things that you can do on the internet. We talked about, you know, how do we get, you know, Mark Zuckerberg or Jack Dorsey to do the right thing or make their platforms a place where everybody can, you know, come together and be happy. But once you start to run a forum like that, Leo, right, you realize it's easier said than done.
Do you have a forum, Alex?
I mean, I have comments on my Substack newsletter, and they become active at times. I just banned someone for the first time this week, and I sort of went through the same thing where I was like, wait a second, this is my, you know, it's my living room here on the internet, and you're calling me a liar. So
I've always felt that way. Yeah.
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 So see ya.
See ya. And that is not illegal. I mean, it's you have the right to ban people, to kick people, to censor people. But they also have the right to sue you if you don't have the immunities Section 230 provides you.
Yeah. So here's to that law.
Here's to 230. I'll drink to that. Our show today brought to you quite literally by our brand new TriCaster. I want to give some real props to New Tech and their new TriCaster 2 Elite. John is loving it. All of our engineers are loving it. It's the most complete live production system on the planet. We use 1/10 of its capabilities, But we still love our TriCasters. Twit wouldn't exist without the TriCaster. When we started streaming video, of course we chose TriCaster. And now we're using the latest and greatest. It's more than a live video production system. It's an all-encompassing digital media solution people can use to create content for internet, mobile, and television distribution. It's used in so many places. Our new board, that board you see right there, has an instant replay button. We're trying to figure out how we can use that. Maybe the next time I make a pack. It has 10? 9 instant replay buttons. Wow. It's software-driven IP-native technology that gives you the capability, connectivity, and control to take on any sort of digital media production. And it's portable. I mean, we've got it rack-mounted, but we've also taken it on the road. It's amazing. When you consider the sheer variety of features that NewTek offers with their TriCaster series, no other live production solution enables digital workflows like the TriCaster 2 Elite. There's Live Call Connect, which we haven't started using, but I'm excited about that. It lets you connect to anyone, anywhere, on any device with high-quality video and audio. You can use Skype, Microsoft Teams, Zoom meetings, Slack, everything. There's the integrated live set technology. You may not realize it, but I'm actually at home in my jammies. But thanks to NewTek's TriCaster 2 Elite, I look like I'm in a studio dress. No, I am. We don't. That's one feature we probably should use more of. But the live set technology is amazing. And you get full access to a premium library of virtual sets. So you can create a simulated environment that suits your style and your brand. And man, they have such a good matte technology built in. It's so amazing. Don't leave out the Live Graphics Creator plugin either. You can design animated titles, motion graphics. I'm sure Anthony's going to start doing some stuff with that, looping effects. And you can do it with Creative Cloud. The lower third you're seeing was created in Photoshop and then imported directly into your TriCaster live production system. It's one of the reasons our fonts look so much better now, because we're using Photoshop. Live Graphics Creator lets produce and present spectacular live graphics faster and easier than ever before. We're just scratching the surface with this new TriCaster 2 Elite. And when you're ready to take your production live, that's when we really get excited. That's what we do. You can stream it live to your choice of new media platforms, the convenient presets for Facebook Live, Microsoft Azure, Twitch, YouTube Live, and more. It's flexible. It's powerful. It's easy to use. But most importantly, TriCaster 2 Elite frees you from the boundaries of live video production. The sky's the limit. It's transformative. It's better than broadcast. And we love it. Thank you, NewTek, for our TriCaster 2 Elite. Go to NewTek, NewTek.com/TriCaster. There's an interactive guide that'll help you choose the TriCaster right for you. We're pretty happy to have the top of the line, I got to say, the TriCaster 2 Elite. NewTek, NewTek.com/TriCaster. And I think, as we assimilate the capabilities of this, you're going to see more and more of the TriCaster 2 Elite's features be used. We're really excited about the NDI, the network digital interface that replaces SDI, and it gives us all sorts of capability. It's really, really fantastic. NewTek.com/TriCaster. Thank you, NewTek. We are eternally grateful.
You know what? I bet there's about to be a bunch of lawsuits, though, because there was so much community sleuthing. I don't know what to call it. In the days since the stampede on the Capitol, all of these people and organizations are going through meticulously every single image and every single person to identify everybody who took part in that. And they're, doing that really effectively and funneling that back up to law enforcement, which is a good thing. But I just wonder how many people are now going to turn around. Like, a whole bunch of people just got put on a permanent no-fly list. There are all these videos now going around showing the people who were who attacked the Capitol at the airport finding out that they are no longer allowed to fly.
Wow.
So there are all of these additional – there's this entire sort of like swirl of media that's generated. And I guess technically they were in a public space. This is probably having more to do with – I don't think Section 230 intersect, or maybe it intersection some ways. But my point is, there's a whole bunch of people who are about to find out that they've lost a lot of their privileges and are going to be arrested and a bunch of other things because they were identified, even if they had their faces mostly covered up.
Yeah, well, just a point, you know, next time you want to take over the Capitol building, don't take selfies. And remember, there's a lot of cameras around, a lot of them. This is probably the best documented attempt, coup attempt ever in history.
I have a friend who works. So I've got some friends who work for the Capitol Police. And
oh, I'd love to hear their story.
So, yes, I don't think I should tell it. But I will say this. One of them said a military coup. We think of a coup as having the sort of person in charge direct the military to do whatever they want. But in effect, directing the National Guard to not act was also a use of military forces,
good
right?
Point.
I mean, it was a coup by in a different way by methodically and actively not having anybody show up.
Yeah.
Putting
Maryland's Governor Hogan is hopping mad. Yeah. He said, I kept trying to offer him the National Guard.
As he should be.
Yeah.
He should be pissed.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a whole lot that we're still yet to learn about all of these things. And Amy's point's a really important one about people being identified. And for all the sort of quiet pleasure I get in bad people being called to account for what they've done, I'm a little worried about some of the follow-on effects of the notion that we can that everything we do in public, even if it's not meant to be done, might someday be used against us. And then the other thing, which is that again and again in these situations, people who are actually not there have been accused of having been there, going back a long time. But the Boston bombing a few years ago was such a case. We have to be really careful that the tarring and feathering that we might want to do, first of all, don't do it to people who weren't there. But at what point is the punishment disproportionate? And we don't know yet in a lot of these situations. And we have to be it's the wrong time to be making laws is when you're in a total anger phase, as the Patriot Act showed. And I think this is related to the sort of shoot then aim things we do on social media. We should try to find ways to take a breath and not overreact instantly. And in many of these cases, we're not overreacting. But I'm concerned about our, there's a certain level of anger that people get and then stop seeing clearly.
We've talked about this before, Amy. I mean, you were talking about it earlier. The government is intentionally slow and slow moving and deliberative. And while that's difficult and when it comes to regulating technology, which moves at about 10 times faster speed, it's not such a bad idea to
well, no, I
down.
Mean, look at the rancor and the emotional roller coaster that we've been on, which has been challenging for everybody, regardless of what your politics are, happened because we faced such an abrupt and decisive change between the Obama administration and the Trump administration. That amount of change in government and all of the, again, that had next order consequences. So all of the other changes that entailed became really difficult for us to sort of deal with in society. So we don't want government, we don't want that to happen. We don't want this level of rancor and political we don't want this amount of political rancor to infiltrate every single aspect of our daily lives, whether that is how technology is being used, or stuff having to do with cars or, you know, whatever. So we actually want our government to move deliberately, slowly, with less politics being a part of it. So I think the challenge for us going forward is figuring out how to slow everything down. Literally, as we've been talking, Nancy Pelosi just sent a letter that is now posted on the speaker's website, saying that the House is voting, that they've basically called on Pence to respond within 24 hours to a resolution calling to invoke the 25th Amendment.
Wow. So I don't know again, if it works like, that way, but okay.
Well, but the fact that that is, I don't think the point of that was Pence. I think the point of that was a public display via using the media and, right. and social media. And what does that do? It further inflames everybody. So we're operating, government isn't, we need to be more thoughtful. I mean, I know this sounds like common sense, but we don't act this way. We all need to be much more thoughtful and think through the consequences of the decisions or, you know, non-decisions that we're making. Last thing, because I mentioned Capitol Police. So I'm friends with a person who used to be the chief of police for Washington, D.C. And she was telling me about the challenge in Washington, D.C. There are, this number may not be right, but I think there's something like 27 different police forces all operating in the district, which means that depending on, like, between, you know, where they were standing on the Capitol and the sidewalk across the street, there may be three or four different jurisdictions. And they slice and dice that very specifically, which means that if there is a threat, if something is about to happen, and you know because you've been seeing it bubble up, that you can't have a federation of 27 different police forces that are just going to magically come together like Voltron and save the day. You know, you need a higher authority. You need more leadership. And in the absence of that leadership, one has to ask, you know, if you're not putting government to work in a positive way, then again, all we're left with is that it was deliberate. Mm-hmm. I mean, how sad is that for?
It may have an unintended consequence, because I think there's now a bit of a drumbeat to make D.C. a state. Which would solve some of those problems, but would also guarantee two more Democratic senators. So that would be kind of...
And we'd need to change the flag, which nobody wants to do.
Oh, and nobody wants
to
do that.
That's the big thing.
That's a lot of work. I'll end with a couple of good news points before we take a break. SolarWinds has hired Chris Krebs as a consultant. Krebs, of course, the former cybersecurity chief who got fired because he said the election was flawless. But I think that's a good sign. And then the State Department is setting up a new Bureau for Cybersecurity and Emerging Technologies. I don't know if this is going to be what you were advocating with this Office of Strategic Planning, but it's a step in the right direction. CSET will help lead diplomatic efforts around security, including working to prevent cyber conflicts with potentially adversarial nations. At this point, a diplomatic solution to the SolarWinds hack seems like probably the only reasonable approach. There's certainly no technical solution. It's pretty much the worst hack anybody's ever seen. So a couple of, I think, good steps in the right direction. Interesting article on Substack as well by Matt Stoller. His big newsletter, where he talks about the real problem at SolarWinds was the fact that it was bought by a private equity company, Orlando Bravo, which immediately, as has happens with private equity companies, cut costs, cut security, moved its programmers to Eastern Europe, and in effect, created a real threat to a security company that offers software is used by millions of private firms. So that's another kind of interesting.
That's
issue.
Amazing. I didn't hear that.
Yeah.
That piece.
Yeah, private equity kind of wrecks everything it touches, and you don't want it to be touching things that relating to national security because it wrecks
I'm really surprised.
Everything it touches.
Yeah.
I'm shocked that that was allowed to, that that sale was allowed to go through.
Well, what Stoller suggests is that when you, you know, procure, certainly in government, but anytime you procure a security solution, you might want to consider who owns it and what their track record is. This is one of the reasons SolarWinds update server's password was SolarWinds123. It wasn't well secured, and as a result, essentially every government agency has been hacked, and many other companies, private and public. So
I should have gone with password. That would have been
password is much more effective. Yeah, that's the Spaceballs password,
right, with a zero instead of a whoa.
But it's good they added the 123 though. It adds a little bit of numerical.
Well, something. I'll have to try that to see if I can get into my face, my Bitcoin wallet. Maybe I might have used that actually. Bitcoin, what is it now? $40,000 down to 37. Damn it! I knew I should have sold. It's a great article in Bloomberg. Day trader heaven arrives as Tesla, Bitcoin, and stock options surge. Everybody looks like they're geniuses till it crashes. But I'm not going to say anything. Actually, somebody I thought was intelligent say, oh, now Bitcoin can never crash. It's only up, up, up.
There's a method. Yeah. I'm really glad to see there's a way to go short.
Short Bitcoin, huh?
Or buy puts anyway. I mean, this is a great great opportunity to make some money,
but it's so volatile. Yeah, it's so volatile. We always end the show with obituaries. The father of fiber optics passed. He lived to a ripe old 94. Narinder S. Kapani, a physicist and entrepreneur who did more than anyone to make optical research a priority in government and corporate budgets. This is a picture of him in 1955. It was very early work. And it's kind of amazing, really, the amount of data glass fibers can carry when you pass light down it is astounding.
He was doing that in 1955?
In 1955, yeah.
It's really amazing.
I know. He was at the Imperial College London. He entered graduate school there in 1952. For decades, researchers across Europe, I'm reading from the New York Times obituary, had been studying ways to transmit light through flexible glass fibers, but a host of technical challenges had set them back. He persuaded Harold Hopkins to hire him as a research assistant. Hopkins, as a theoretician, provided the ideas. Dr. Kapani figured out the practical side. And in 1954, they published in the journal Nature demonstrating how to bundle thousands of impossibly thin glass fibers together and then connect them end to end. Yeah, 1954.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And a good reminder that it's a good reminder for us to be patient because groundbreaking technology takes time to operationalize and bring to the market.
Who is it that said new technologies both take longer than you expect and happen faster than you think? Or longer than you think and faster than you expect?
Yeah, I've heard flavors of that out of Bill Gates and many others.
Along those lines, Amy, we're still waiting for a lot of the internet access providers in the United States to discover fiber.
So yeah, someday they'll
wonderful when
they'll do. Discover it, and boy, oh boy, that'll be amazing. Quibi, which raised $1.75 billion and then failed in 6 months, has sold off its assets to Roku for less than $100 million, according to Ars Technica. They got a little money back. I have no idea what Roku wants to create a Quibi channel, I think. The good news is there are Quibi producers, documentarians and such, who were cut off with the failure of Quibi in the middle of their production. This will give them some opportunity to finish what they were doing, which is a good thing. So Roku bought not only the existing Quibi library, but anything in production now.
This is how we know that 2021 is going to be a good year. Because if Quibi can be revived in some form this year, and things are looking up for us.
Even better.
We might have democratic stability.
Who knows?
Vaccines and this pandemic.
My God.
And then of course, we'll be able to realize Quibi's initial vision, which is we watch those short little
on a TV, finally.
But even without it, I think we'll be fine.
There was some good stuff on Quibi. What they did not buy, by the way, Roku did not get the technology that let you switch.
Well, that's what was the, whatever that magic, they had a name for it. I don't remember what it was. Did. That was the innovation. That was actually pretty slick.
Yeah, that nobody cared about. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's creative destruction I can really get behind.
Hey, what a great panel you are. I thank you for spending some time, a lot of time with us, discussing some of the hardest issues in technology today. And with aplomb and smarts, and you made it fun. So thank you, Amy Webb. It's always a thrill to have you on. I really appreciate everything you do. Her books are...
Can I say thanks? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Let me give you your plug.
Yes, plug my book.
Then you can say anything you want. Her books are at amyweb.io, The Big Nine, The Signals Are Talking. And her first book, Data, A Love Story, How I Cracked the Online Dating Code to Meet My Match. And yes, she's happily married and has a lovely daughter. And so that's all three of those are well worth reading. And of course, her company is the Future Today Institute. You can go there, futuretodayinstitute.com. And play with what is one of the most coolest things on any website, which is this little tool that lets you predict the future by tying together disparate threads. And then you can also get the calendar, which I highly recommend. There's the threads. We can drag these around and show what they do and all of that stuff. Maybe that's in the menu.
No, that's it. It's not. I mean, it's somewhat interactive. We're building out more functionality.
Good.
But thank you for having me on, as always. But I also want to say thank you to everybody who works in IT, who I know is listening. You've got a rough couple of weeks ahead of you. I consider you to be first responders. I know that you don't get the thanks that you deserve because you are the ones who are keeping everything going. So I just wanted to say, I just wanted to know that you are appreciated and that I thank you for all of the work that you're doing.
So well said. And man, if you're in IT in the Capitol building and you know that the evil made problem times 1,000, you know, all of those machines, people fled their offices without logging out, without shutting down. And you had people playing with them and you have no idea what's been compromised, what hasn't. I know you're going to have a tough couple of weeks, so thank you. That's really great. Thank you, Amy. We always forget that. It's great to see you, Dan Gilmore. It's been too long. We'll get you back very soon. DanGilmore.com. He's at Arizona State working on media literacy, making people smarter. Is that at ASU's Walter Cronkite School, or where is that?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh man, that's a great place. Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication in the lab there. Really great. DanGilmore.com. Thank you, Dan.
It's great to be with you again, and let's do it again.
I will. We will soon. You know, it's funny. We got a new producer, Jason Howell, and he said, "You know, you haven't had Dan Gilmore on in a while." I said, "What?" So I was very pleased. You know, these things, they slip my mind. That's what we have producers for, because my mind is it's just a bunch of mush. And Jason also said, "And by the way, you got to get Alex on too. Alex Kantrowitz, his big technology newsletter is at bigtechnology.substack.com. How much does that cost to subscribe to that?"
It's free for now.
What?
I run it ad supported, so it's free to subscribe, and we'll see how things go down the line.
You've worked. Tell me some of the places you've worked. You worked at a lot of these big name tech sites.
Yeah, I was part of the original team that came over as BuzzFeed started its bureau here in Silicon Valley, and was at AdAge before that. And previously, actually spent some time working in tech. I was selling ad tech before I made my way into journalism. So if anybody out there wants to jam about order management systems for publishers, I'd be happy to talk with you.
It's been great to meet you, Alex. And you were great to have on the show. We'll have you back real soon. Alex Kantrowitz, bigtechnology.substack.com. And search for his Big Technology podcast. You just had, I really want to listen to the one you just did with Kevin Roos. That is very timely. The making of a YouTube radical. Kevin talks about how YouTube can radicalize. And then you had Mark Ledwich taking issue, saying, you know, my research shows that YouTube does not radicalize. What a great topic.
And, yeah, it was super fun. Yeah. I mean, Mark was basically like telling Kevin, I don't agree with what you're saying. And I will debate you about it, but only if we do it on Big Technology Podcast. So
perfect.
It's only a couple months old, but it was a good sign. And we got some new good shows coming up this upcoming week. I had Ryan Mack from BuzzFeed News, a former colleague of mine, on. And then the Twitter ban of Trump broke in the middle of that discussion. So our reaction is on that. And we kind of give some live updates about what it means and where things go from here.
You also interview my personal Peloton instructor, Emma Lovewell.
Emma Lovewell, I mean, she's unbelievable. I
take all her classes.
She kicks my butt every time.
I love her classes. Live well, love well, she says at the end of them, and I'm going,
that's right. When I catch my breath.
Whatever you say. So I'll be listening to that one. Big Technology Podcast. It's on Apple Podcasts and everywhere you can get your podcasts. Of course, we are too. Don't forget to take our survey. We really appreciate that. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon, 2:30 Pacific, 5:30 Eastern, 22:30 UTC. If you like to watch the sausage being made, we do have a behind-the-scenes audio and video feed of everything we do. Unedited, unexpurgated. The truth comes out sometimes before and after the shows. You can watch that at twit.tv/live. If you're watching live, you can watch live with a lot of other people watching live in our arm's length chat room at irc.twit.tv. They're not really arm's length. They're just, I can almost reach them. irc.twit.tv. All of our shows, for everything we do, available on our website, of course, twit.tv. There's a YouTube channel for every show, including this one, This Week in Tech, on YouTube. And, of course, it's a podcast, so you can subscribe, audio or video. Use your favorite podcast client and subscribe. That way you'll get it automatically every Sunday evening after the show's over. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Good luck next week. Please stay safe. Wear your mask. Wash your hands. Socially distance. Because we can't afford to lose another one of you. So please, we'll see you next week. Another Twit.
This is amazing.